I'm with Derek DeKirchhoff again. He's in Europe, and I'm in Hawaii. And we're going over Barry Nevitz. We're continuing what we did before. We're going over Barry Nevitz's interesting layout of 10 points about what one does in a post-media ecology world. And Barry Nevitz presented this 30 years ago, 1980, 35 years ago. And we've done a few of the 10 sections. We've done economics, politics, management, maybe some education. Now, he has something here called correction, which means prison life. So under correction, he says, to convert the culprits not merely outside, but inside out, by understanding the laws of their situation rather than destroy them totally by preconceptions, and to recognize that the current alternative to written law, which lags further and further behind justice, is tribal law, which leaps further and further beyond it, beyond written law. That's,
all right.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well,
what comes to mind, Derek?
It is. And it reflects old Chinese wisdom, which considered prison as a place for genuine internal reform and not a punishment. So, but I am really very keen on looking at how such brilliant thoughts can help the present situation. I have a very great difficulty getting to sleep without thinking about how it feels to have a butcher's knife going through your throat. the atrocities that are happening right now hit me personally, and I'm sure that they hit everybody else personally. Hence, they are of the most urgent nature, and precisely what kind of correction can be applied to pacify such absolute barbarism. I mean, I find that every time somebody's throat is being cut off, heads of government say that they are horribly shocked. So am I. We're all horribly shocked, and I don't think that saying that we're horribly shocked is going to help a lot. It's just a matter of how does one apply correction to people who use the media to actually scandalize to the core the world population to actions that have actually no bearing with human comportment, human behavior, standard human behavior, let alone democracy and religious whatever. This is well beyond all these what we think are still normal categories. And I'm saying, what kind of correction? How can you get inside these guys and not destroy them totally by preconception? How do you actually take the place of this English-speaking executioner who, all dressed in black, is actually slicing the throats of somebody in front of the television camera? How do you change that?
Okay. I want to say first, Marsh McLuhan nailed it. If you have a familiarity with explorations, he quotes in one of the items in explorations, he has I don't know if it's from the Bible or from Greek literature, I don't think it specifies. He talks about men coming and slaying, brutally whole tribes. And it just goes into graphic detail.
Mm-hmm.
And back when you read that in late 50s, early 60s, it's quite shocking, this violent scenario that Marshall presents without explanation. But when we learn more about Marshall, we understand.
Yes,
let me finish. That we learn that the global village is a time of violence, then we see that Marshall predicted this.
Well, no, but hang in there. It was not a prediction, it was an observation, because what he was describing in those days was what was happening under the eyes of my father in Israel and in Palestine, where he was between 1949 and 1952. For 3 years, he went from village to village seeing members of bodies nailed to the doors of the houses, seeing a bus that had been overturned with all the women's bodies carrying a severed man's head on their lap, lying on their back, and all the men carrying a woman's head. This kind of tribal atrocity has occurred and has been occurring for a long time. we didn't pay much attention to it because it didn't happen in our backyard. It does happen in our backyard now, and that's the power of ISIS and how they have played their media game. And this is exactly a media situation. I'm perfectly happy with, you know, reading Barry saying it's tribal law, which leads further and further beyond. We are further beyond it now. What do we do with it?
Okay, so yes, you say that's not a prediction, it's an observation, and it was a hidden ground. And
it's an observation, and but the prediction that's missing is what I am saying now, that once it's carried by media, it's an entirely different story.
Right, but we know the quote he did in the 60s in the hot and
it's
cool
not
simply, interview.
You know, we can expect, it's not...
No, let me
no,
say
no, but
this.
It's not simply, well,
listen,
you know,
listen,
we're going to put tribal ways to take
I
over
know.
And win. No!
I want to give you the background.
It's actually tribal ways to take over Iruna.
Yeah, listen, just relax.
wrong,
I just want to, for the record, say that there's a quote in Hot and Cool by Gerald Stern where Marshall says, global village people butcher each other. He does say that. It's not a pastoral image. So he predicted this violence.
We're not disputing the prediction.
What?
Of course he did. He did. But may I for the, in fear of repeating myself, what is not specified is the difference with the situation now, where that tribal violence is not simply practiced, it's distributed. And it's distributed in a way which in itself is of immense violence. I live in Rome. I am like a half a day's boat trip from Libya, where ISIS is taking over and has already threatened to come into Rome. I am one of these civils, which is, I am in the first civil war, as world civil war, as somebody else predicted. Paul Guerrero said, we're not in the third, we're not at the third world war. It's not going to happen. What we are into is the first world civil war. That's very powerful, and that's very real, because it is the media that makes it the world civil war.
Marshall.
And it's done in such a way that violence is multiplied instantly by the fact that it's put on television.
Okay, I got that.
Marshall,
it's not the first civil war.
The Vietnam War on TV. I know all of this. I know, but it's
listen,
pretty serious.
Derek,
I mean,
Derek, you're making
Marshall
mistakes, Derek. You're making mistakes in your emotional tribal paranoia. Listen, Marshall says back in the 50s, every war is a global civil war. Every war is a civil war under television conditions. He wrote that in 1954 in an article called Sight and Sound,
Good.
Sight and Fury.
Well, I'm glad somebody did. Okay, well, as Baudrillard stole a lot from Marshall, I didn't say that Baudrillard. I should have said that that's Guerrero who said that. But I don't think Guerrero was stealing anything from Marshall. Baudrillard did quite a bit. Eventually was reconciled with the idea. But no, really, seriously, let's try and see how these various sections of Barry's legacy, so to speak, are playing into where we are now. I'm talking about correction. Another correction, it's going to be have to be self-correcting, but another correction is what's now called SwissLeaks. Did you hear about SwissLeaks?
Say that word again.
SwissLeaks. There is WikiLeaks and there's this leaks and that leaks, but this is called SwissLeaks. And what it is the publishing of the names of about 100,000 people who have foisted their money into a Swiss bank with the help of HSBC, which is one of the biggest Swiss banks. And so the big difference between SwissLeaks and WikiLeaks is that WikiLeaks actually was a very strong revelation of our institutional behavior, CIA and so on. But SwissLeaks is the revelation of our private behavior, personal behavior, legal or not. What I'm saying is SwissLeaks is way more important than WikiLeaks was in terms of how transparency is arriving in our lives now. And that also is affected by the issue of correction. How does one correct oneself when one is transparent? That's one of the questions I'm asking myself now.
You can't correct yourself. You got to give up. You got to recognize that you got to recognize that you're dead.
No.
You recognize.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, you don't say, you don't lose your ego, you don't give up your vanity, you recognize that you will be offed within 5 minutes. When you start to get to live like that, you're a warrior. you're ready to die. And then you can relax. And then probably it won't come to you.
Very relaxed. I may sound excited, but I am actually quite relaxed. But I really think it's fine. We talk about Marshall, we talk about Barry, we talk about people, but I have to actualize. I've always had to do this. I have to actualize what they were saying into what's happening today. And that's what I'm saying. Correction is a great theme because it deals with ethics. It deals with public and social and private morality. It deals with what we think is right and what we think is wrong. And it deals with handling problems such as the one that we are facing now. That's what I'm saying. How do we look at correction in an era of transparency? How do we look at correction in the era of video-promoted brutality?
We don't. Not, it's total anarchy, and no institutions are going to protect anybody. Prisons are run as cities now. The prisoners run the prisons. I know this from knowing people in jail. It is not what people think is going on in prisons. It's just a total, like Woodstock, an instant city. Well, prisons are instant cities. So none of the laws that anybody talks about in civilized behavior are going to be followed anymore. So you're on your own, and you better be cool how you interact with people. Maybe you turn Japanese and start respecting everybody and nodding to them because they could pull a knife on you any minute. So this thing of...
Well, they have.
Now, in the chip with the five-body model, the chip body dominant, the chemical body, the physical body becomes a ghetto, a global hood, if you want to use a violent image of black ghettos in the United States. So the world's a hood now, and these guys, gangbangers, are taking advantage of that potential that you can grab anybody and cut their head off. And they're not following any laws about who they're picking. They'll pick anybody. So we are in, you know, Vico's chaos. We are in Vico's chaos.
I know we are. It's not nice. But do you want to stay that way?
Well, what are you going to – what can – nobody can do anything about it. If they start to make a group action, look at Mexico. Tremendous murders going on daily of any student who attempts to lead any kind of action, even a chess club, is murdered right in front of their home. Do you know about that this summer, this past 6 months,
yes.
What's going on in Mexico?
I do. 43 of them.
That's minor.
I realize.
It's happening all over the place. And the government outlawed the demonstrations, these mass demonstrations. So you have a standoff with every institution becomes a fascist, communist, a rigid totalitarian expression, from publishing through to CBC to prisons to tribal groups around the world. Everybody is in this war against the physical body. And so you... Mm-hmm. You wouldn't. There's no institution you can go to implement a program. You want to get panic? I'll take it even further. There is total chaos. You are not safe, Derek.
I know that, but that's. I can't say that I'm terribly afraid of that. I'm more concerned about the general state of the world today. My own personal. How would I say? I don't feel personally threatened. I feel collectively threatened. So do you.
No, I feel it's more personal threatened. The collective is gone. The collective is unhealthy in many ways, from health, medicine. Nobody is doing the professions in any level of competence. And so you are on your own, and you have the media. You have the super angel state your chip body gives you. You can create your own little empires, your own little gangs. So everybody is a tribal emperor among themselves, among whoever they align with. You're on your own. This total fragmentation on the individual level now. Total, extreme fragmentation.
That's actually a good point. No. It's a good point, but I still believe that a social order will be self-emerging if not being, supported. And it eventually will, because when I'm looking back at the history of the Renaissance and of how religious wars were as brutal as anything we see now, and I can actually add that we are in a religious war today as well. With all the pretense and the falsehood that accompanies a religious war, we certainly are in one, except that neither you or I are a Sunni or a Shi'ite, but that's what's happening, right? So, but I think your point is well taken. However, overall, I have some kind of hope, if not optimism, about the fact that during the Renaissance, we've had some of the absolute worst brutalities that one can imagine. And at the same time, we did eventually get out of it. The point is, how do we get out of this one?
Well, I personally am bringing in cold fusion, a new energy box, and that will upset the stability of the oil company's domination. So I personally am going to bring in a way that's going to change the dynamic in the economy, but nobody knows whether I'm telling the truth or not, so I don't want to go that way. I'm not going to go into this. But I tell you, I'm going to do it, Derek. I personally, my wife and I and someone else,
we have the resources
do this. And you know what?
Yeah, but here is another, since we are shifting to economics, I can give you one more. But anyway, go ahead.
And I think even if we had this cold battery, cold fusion, I'm going to call it that. It's not, we call it cold play. But this box, the government in the United States can grab it for national security reasons. So how are we going to do this? We're going to give it away for free. We're going to start distributing this all over the place for free, and people start to implement it. And once they have their energy needs, their shelter needs, their heat needs, and whatever cold play is used for, that alters the slavery to the oil consciousness. And now the violence will continue.
Oh, yeah.
But as more and more people get the box, they can implement it. So it'll be just like a dramatic Hollywood movie. You'll be implementing the box while ducking bullets being shot at you. That's what the world is today.
Well, you know, another prediction of the world we're in was done by Buñuel, the famous Spanish filmmaker.
Yes.
In The Phantom of Liberty, he has Fernando Rey, who is one of his favorite actors, walking with, I think, Catherine Deneuve or somebody, I can't remember who, but one really sweet young thing, and he's walking in the streets of, I think, could be Barcelona or Madrid, and as they walk, there's an explosion on the right, and there's another one on the left, and there's another one on the right again, and they just keep walking.
I agree with that. That is a good scenario.
That's what I thought you do. That's what I'm feeding to you to support your idea.
Good
think,
quote.
No, and I think you're right. And I think you're right. And I think it's a very good thing that we bring this up by this discussion. But I was going to say, I'm glad that you've got the box. I hope it works. But I would like to suggest that in the world of economics today, things are changing extremely fast. And one of the old elephants and the dying mammoth of the industry was what we call manufacture, and we actually exported all our manufacturing to China because that's where we could get actually things done for cheap, and then we sort of lost our own manufacturers, and in fact, we basically are today, yes, buying our products cheaply, but we've also lost the sources of our economy and working possibilities for 100,000 million people. Okay. But there is something that's happening now that I find very interesting in terms of how it could change the economics, is that it's called by some people manufacturing 2.0. It's the use of 3D printing for just anything you want, anything, including molecules to cure you from cancer.
Yes.
That's an extraordinary thing because you can do it at home. You can do it on something that doesn't cost you much more than a standard paper printer. And it does you, I've seen it at work, and you can have different levels of quality of it and the more refinement, but basically it is putting in the hands of everybody the tools of production, much more so than simply doing so in information media, because I used to make fun before by saying, you know, Marx would be so happy because now the tools of production of the principal aspect of our economy are in the hands of the producer, of the worker, like you and me. Mike Wesch calls this the machine is using us. So be it. What I'm saying is a new kind of independent income-producing activity that can actually be developing from the time of school all the way to adulthood is now available. And it's something that is indeed threatening to change the grounds of the whole manufacturing business and manufacturing economy. It might actually put a few Chinese people to trouble.
Okay.
They would produce the machine that destroys their own income.
Right. But
how do you do that?
we also have a revolution in medicine we're going to bring in, me and Carolyn and our friend. Now, I'm saying that, yes, all these breakthrough technologies are here. Whether they find you is up to you. Whether you're open-minded or lucky enough to find out or informed enough. So we are going to get breakthrough situations, and in the long run, it will diminish the violence on the TV spectacle level. It will still happen always, occasionally.
Sure.
So I agree that there's so much good news on breakthrough technologies that some of us are going to live to experience that and have it. And it can even start now with our medicine, our particular medicine. So the thing is, the solutions are here, and the media, what we call the TV body, which is where you sit back and watch it, it's not necessarily as interactive as a chip body, but you watch it, it is going to create a biggest horror show as possible just to keep people looking at it. So I do not pay attention to these horrible scenarios that are happening, because it distracts from my sense of power and my sense of being affected by it. Now, if suddenly Mr. Obama wants me to come to the White House and make a bunch of speeches and this and that, I'd do that. And they'd run around and try to implement it and say, no, we can't do this. The humans in mass are not going to fucking correct anything. It's going to happen with these technologies that you're talking about being available, and you personally, if you're lucky enough and informed, will find out about it and implement it. That's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. No, really, I agree. No, I agree. And in fact, I am a bit like you, although for me it's a bit different in that, as I said, do feel very much for the people who are under such suffering, because now it's so much in my face.
Right, and you're a teacher. You have to have something to say to the next generations. And so let's figure out, what will we say to a 20-year-old? I would try to make the 20-year-old aware of the intensities that we're talking about, using McLuhan, because he's pretty realistic, catch them up to date, then do the other media schools of media ecology, which we're going to go through, and we have the information. And if a kid can't take it, it's not your fault. You've got to be tough to live today. You can be compassionate, but you've got to be tough.
You've
got to be a warrior. And these kids who are being put on drugs very early and medicated by the time they're 20, and they have medications in the cafeterias, that's disgusting. And if they can't wake up to the weakness they're being programmed to be in, then so be it. We can be an example, but you can't expect 100% communication effect.
The French say you can bring the camels to the water, you can't force it to
Right. I think the tribalism that began with speech, then through writing, then books, then media, electric media, tribalism is dead, and the kids live that way. They don't follow any cultural laws. They improvise all kinds of bizarre behavior, personal, sexual, whatever. They're on their own. They know it. These kids are pretty smart. Now, they might burn themselves out. I have a new show called What Youth every Tuesday, and I have these young people come on, and I don't even think the category youth is applicable today. So What Youth? And they tell me what the kids are. A lot of them are very burnt out by the time they're 19 and 20. So we have to provide ways for them to relax, thought forms that help them relax. The panic in the media is a joke, and that'll continue. And they don't even watch that stuff. Though I did notice there was a lot of panic about the Ebola virus among young people. There were many kids killing themselves thinking they were going to die, die from the virus. So we are in hyper panic, hyper hysteria, hyper schizophrenia, hyper ecstasy, and hyper paranoia. That's a given. And a politician is silly. Any politician gets on there and starts talking in platitudes, he's probably a criminal, because he's so out of touch with any perception of the present that he says stupid things like that and thinks it'd be palliative. You know, the irresponsibility of public communication is a joke. All right? I don't take anybody seriously on that level. Even, one of the best things...
I agree.
You know what the news anchors should do? They should just read from Finnegan's Wake, because that's the reality. Multiple languages, multiple media, incomprehensibly collaged at you.
I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like it to be done in Italy too. See, how do you translate Finnegan Wake in Italian? And Mr. Renzi.
No, you cannot.
Television platform.
You cannot limit it to univocal. It's a polyvocal book. It's not to be put into any univocal. As a put-on, you can translate it approximately using McHugh's annotations into Italy, into Italian, as a 5-minute spiel, but then you revert to the polyverbal to show that it's not just univocal. So rigorous training of perception can be done in 5 minutes now, Derek. You can end your course in 5 or 10 minutes with a reasonably smart kid.
What kind of accent? I like polyvocal, but what kind of accent will you put to reading Finnegan's Wake if you do it in Italy?
You would have a different accent for every word. If you read half a page, you try to get 20 accents in there, because there are 60 languages on each page of Finnegan's Wake. 60 languages. So you can do an accent if you know how to do them for a word or two, and then switch it to a Swedish accent, then do an African accent, then do a South American.
It would be very good.
And that would not even be close
but
to the media world. You know, Derek, I say to people that the media is not talking to you. It's not talking to your chemical body, your chemical body or brain. It is talking to other parts of the media networking. It is not talking to your chemical body. That would help people if they were trained to see that the media is not talking to them. They do not, in that sense, it's a post-information world, a post-messaging world. Mm-hmm. It really is. And I think it's irresponsible that teachers in high schools do not present this information. They are afraid to.
Yeah, I agree. But here's another thought. One of the questions that was asked from me 2 days ago by an interviewer, what was happening to language? Since language was so important, what was happening with young people's use of language? And I said, well, actually, language is moving from descriptive to operative, that every actual message is not something that is contained and is actually something you can mull about. It's basically an order.
Yes.
Tweets are simply they're darts. They're not reflections. They're not action. They're action oriented. It's like the icons on our screens. They're all verbs, not nouns anymore.
Yes. No, I agree. It's declarative. It's creating your space. You're creating your space, and you see who bites.
Mm-hmm.
You're letting the flag go up the flagpole, see who salutes. Everybody is probing. The very thing that Marshall claimed he did, every citizen is forced to be nowadays. Everybody, all around the world. You have to be a prober.
Can we get back to the youth business? I like very much this suggestion you made of, first of all, the title, What Youth, is excellent. But I wanted to know what the process was. How many people do you get? Where do you get them? And what did they say?
Well, these are young people who are extremely blissed out on our medical products. They feel very healthy and energized. They also understand that we'll probably bring you forth a cold fusion. So they're victims of my cult, okay? Carol and my cult. And they love us and love talking, so I said, let's come on. And my agenda is, with their help, is to start a revolution, knowing that all revolutions that we can imagine have happened. So how could you even have a revolution? So we probe the idea of maybe we can organize people, young people, to agree to this language that I'm saying we must all use for public communication. And use bits of Croker, McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, de Kirchhoff, myself. In other words, we're running a revolution, and our agenda is to pull this off without getting killed. So actually, we spend a lot of time we spend a lot of time joking.
One should. But listen, have you interviewed Croker as well on these series?
Not on today. I interviewed him twice in 2004. I can send you links if you want to hear it. It's a pretty up-to-date interview. It has staying power. But I have not talked to him on a public level for many years. He's very busy with his own operation of Victoria.
I think he's a man of lots of ideas and a thorough thinker. I actually respect him a lot.
Yes, no, he's useful. But I think that with my, we have a new way to attract people. We have something that makes them feel eternal. Our stuff is the best medicine in the world. It's fantastic, and we got more and more young people feeling good.
Enough hard sell, Bob. Let's talk about the content. By the way, just one more person. You should interview Pierre Lévy also. He really is also very bright, and he's working now on something that he calls algorithmic intelligence, and I think there's something to that, and so you should think about
that. What's the name?
Pierre Lévy. He's a Frenchman, but he lives in Canada. He is the director of one of these excellent centers on connected or collective intelligence. And he is really one of the people that I would always, you know, he said something, for example, that immediately rings a bell suddenly with you. He says, Internet is not in space. It is space itself.
Yes, yes.
It is very clever.
That's
the level. And another thing he said, another example to just whet your appetite to just get in touch with him, he said, the opposite of virtual is not real, it's actual. It's not real, it's actual. The opposite of virtual, if you say, what's the alternative to virtual reality or virtual this and virtual that, he said, actual.
Yes, and that would
and
be the present.
More precise.
The actual
that's
would be the nounness
what's
of
happening.
Now.
What, that's not virtual, it's happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the actual.
I think it's very clever.
Yes,
so, he's full of that, and so I recommend him.
All right, I'll look him up. Now, the thing is, we are trying to adopt as much of a megalomaniacal, we have the answer kind of stuff, without being a cult, without having any kind of seriousness, but actually knowing that if more kids found out about our work, they'd be a lot happier. So we're purposeful. And one idea would be to get 50,000 young people to all dress in white and march up, say, Park Avenue or Fifth Avenue, New York City, without any placards, just walk up silently like an army that is not making any explanations of why they have the permission to walk up Fifth Avenue. That's it's sort of like a flash mob with purpose.
Man, let me just tell you, that actually has happened. There were not 50,000. There were five artist friends in Sao Paulo in Brazil when I was there, but I was not among them at the time, but there are still photographs of it. And they all got put into prison because they went up and down the streets with, how you call that, board, but nothing written on them, and they were yelling and screaming without any sound coming out of their mouths, making gestures, and there was nothing, no declaration whatsoever. They were thrown into jail just right away, and they were only put out of jail by the fact of me.
That is excellent.
This was done by a friend, Fred Forrest, who did that, and Fred was a great fan of Marshall and met him. And we actually met all three together in Paris. But just to say that they were thrown to jail and they were only released from jail under the pressure of the organizer of the major BNL, which is art and technology, had a big art and technology section. And in it was like all the arts that were produced this year that were actually showing people what was going on. The guy who was running this was one of the power heads and probably, you know, one of the head honchos of the whole city, and he got my friends out. Otherwise, he'd still be there. That was 1973.
Wow, no, that's pretty good. We'll consider them John the Baptist. We will honor them as early prophets of the movement. No. Isn't it interesting? Non-purpose communication threatens the authorities. Like that's really
that's
good.
That's right. It's beautiful.
But basically, the dilemma for I hear in North America, that the brighter kids study hard in high school to get good marks because they believe they want to do well in university and they think there's something to do well within. They get to university, they find out the professors are very uncharismatic, don't seem to know as much as the kids, and then they are at a loss because they think, I got to prepare for a job, but I'm not learning anything here that prepares me. And I'm not satisfying my interests for my personal eurekas and epiphanies, so they're left stranded. And I am going to provide the course that they require. live on the radio. That's the agenda.
Speaking of that, did you know, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, there was, at McGill University in Montreal, there was a rebellion on the part of the higher classes, students, about the lack of real content that they were getting from their courses about the very themes that were critical to both their career and their exams and whatnot. And they started actually very forcefully and very visibly giving the same classes outside the classes so that when the professors were coming in and out of the classes, they could recognize that their own courses were being given by other students.
Wow. And what happened?
That was another protest. Well, I don't know. I don't think it's still going on because they will be talking about it. But I know that there was some kind of kerfuffle and protest on the part of the teachers, and there was some, also clearly you had two camps saying no, the profs are fine, and other students say no, they're terrible. I mean, I don't know. One has to follow up. I should go back into the newspapers of the time to find out what transpired. But I remember being extremely impressed by students who would have, and you know what, as a teacher myself, I was asked sometime to take this place of another teacher for courses about which I knew absolutely nothing. And there's no question that if you don't know anything and you're teaching a course and you are flitting about trying to say something that might be relevant to students who have had, maybe 3 or 4 months of courses before yourself, you just look like a fool. And you sort of want one of the students who knew more saying, well, look, let's recap what we've learned so far and help this professor out of his misery. But the point is, I was excused for the fact that I did not follow that particular field. There was a lot to do with Foucault, and I was not a great fan of Foucault, I remember, and about, a new form, certain types of thinking that came straight from France, and I distrust French intellectual theorists from the start. But the fact is, they do say interesting things. And I was not able to, I remember distinctly at one of these classes feeling very uncomfortable. And I can imagine a prof who would not just be occasionally in such dire situation, but on a regular basis, you just want to teach a student to take over.
Yeah. I think if I went into class, I think the idea a good teacher would have to be very extreme. Be extreme. I don't know what the administration would say to it, but if you're extreme in some way, and you could use McLuhan to develop really good extreme patterns, you will get their attention. At least, if you turn into almost a psychopath. A verbal psychopath. You're not attacking them, but you're talking with poise and saying things they'd never heard before. That would be the only way to teach. That would command their attention. Mm-hmm. Now, let's just, in light of what we said,
I've been seeking it.
You've been what?
No, I'm saying I've been seeking the attention. I have been seeking the attention of my students as professionally as I could, and I've occasionally, I think, succeeded in keeping their attention. But it's a challenge when you do it, for 70 hours.
Yeah.
Or so.
Okay. Now, we've been...
there's a material to teach.
We've actually upped the ante here. We've gone past the decorum of Vera Nevitz. So in light of what we've just said to each other, I want to read communication and see how it bounces off the mood, the ambience we've created right now. So he says for communication, to anticipate all the main effects of everything natural and artificial. Okay, that means covering a lot of stuff, right? You're going to anticipate the effects of everything, natural and artificial, sacred and profane, dead and alive, and the effects on every other living body and itself. So that's extreme discussion of effects. And then to harmonize programs with their media in order to share intended experience with living beings involved in this communication ecology. I don't know if you can use the term media for kids today. I think you have to bring in my bodies and have harmonized programs with their bodies in order to create an idea of a communication ecology. To perceive that such communication is revolution by conversion, well, it's even revolution if you don't convert them, both inner and outer. And to leave communication between machines to engineers and scientists. Well, everybody is contributing to the evolution of machines now. I mean, young kids try to come up with a program. They're 12 years old, and they hope to attract a company, some big company, that they can get a job. So Barry is definitely didn't anticipate what's going on today. These statements are pretty clever, but they don't deal with the present.
I don't know. I think to anticipate all the main effects of everything natural and artificial, sacred and profane dead in your life, it's a very interesting, very ambitious and very wide vision, wide perception of what should happen. And there's no question that it is a very strong recommendation. But we have to also recognize the fact that technologies themselves now come with their own predictions and their own simulation.
Yeah.
Very little product is sent into a market without some thorough study of that market, with occasional errors like Google Glass or this or that contraption, which eventually are recapped later into something which is much more effective. I mean, we know this is natural to happen, but now, whether in science, in laboratories, in market share research, in focus group, wherever you look at, you have simulations and projections forward. So that has to be, to a certain extent, a response, a present response to the wish of Barry and in communication.
Yes. So the first statement is relevant. The later ones, to harmonize programs with their media, to perceive that such communications revolution by conversion, may be too limited. But the thing is that the most advanced form of being a tetrad manager or to be a media ecologist is another aspect of what most citizens are forced to be in a crude way. The whole population is, you could call it total paranoia. The paranoia in people is they're always studying the effects of things. We have become the highest decibels of communication. We just don't have authorities defining the situation properly, correctly. They're not doing it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Even the book, Big Data, that gives you the latest chaos, but mm-hmm. it's not the right term. You know, big data is not what we're dealing with. It's big mm-hmm. pattern recognition or the obsolescence of pattern recognition. I think that we go back to what you would say to your students about the beheading things. I think they're already praying that they don't get beheaded and aware that it could happen to them. In a way, encourage that paranoia. Mm-hmm. Encourage that. Do not take the media as something that's talking to you. That's the healthiest thing, because you couldn't do any. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. If they decide to hijack me, I'm not going to be protected. Anybody can grab anybody today.
No.
It may end up that I'm saved.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mm-hmm. assumed I'm going to be killed in 10 minutes.
I agree. And this is what you feel threatened.
What'd you say?
You feel threatened. That actually won. I mean, right now, I'm at least presented to offer a job in Albania. Well, half of the Albanian population is Muslim, and the other fact of it is that it's an ex-communist country. It's certainly less safe, it seems to me, certainly less safe than Rome. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, the other day I went to South Africa. Well, I had a choice between Turkish airline and Ethiopian airline. And, well, eventually we ended up in Turkish Airlines. But the idea that it was going to be, you know, from a country where at any point, at any place, you know, an airport or elsewhere, I can be grabbed, and then the next thing I know, I've got my throat slice. Yes, one does have the possibility, just as going to the station in Milano reminds me that back in the 80s, the Red Brigade had exploded a bomb and killed 39 people.
Yes.
You know, one has a feeling now, the same feeling I was describing in The Phantom of Liberty by Buñuel, one has the feeling now that one is exposed anywhere. But the point is, again, if we're back to that subject, I could simply add that the fact that we have it at the media, in our media, and that we don't see the beheadings. We know that they have happened, and if we want to see them, there are the videos available, although YouTube takes them off very quickly after. But what I'm saying is that because they are on our TV and they are live or semi-live or almost live, it is like walking down the street with bombs going everywhere without, you know, paying
yes.
attention.
Yep.
It is like that. And it's not that it's purely a media kind of thing. But let's go back to communication, because there are a couple of things here that we do want to say. When he says harmonizing programs with their media, well, the fact is we are going further and further towards the experiencing things. The media now are trying to get us to experiencing, well, certainly are experiencing things when we you know, think about the people being beheaded. But let's just say that for normal, just an experienced economy is actually building up right now, where the media are trying to simulate maximally all our senses, not just the visual or the auditory,
yes,
including the physical, the sense of tactile, all of these things. So the experience economy is actually the housing program with their media. And the other thing is to perceive that such communication is revolution by conversion. I think you're right by saying it's revolution with or without conversion, but it's also true that it is a deep epistemological transformation that is expected from us as we are being sort of reshaped by our own media. It's an epistemological transformation, and that is conversion.
Yes.
It's not religious conversion, of course, but it's a conversion of state of being, sense of being. For a kid to actually find that he's all alone and that he's on his own and that there's nothing that's going to help him any more than somebody being grabbed by ISIS can be helped, is an epistemological conditioning.
Yeah,
an epistemological attitude. People tend to feel supported by the state of things, by the institutions, by their family, by their neighborhood, more or less. I mean, you may not know your neighbors, but if something really goes wrong, you could expect them to, you know, come to the rescue, maybe.
Well, that's...
But it's not the case now. And so that's it's a very interesting kind of revolution. It really is a revolution.
Well, the reason people are constantly looking at their chip bodies and their texting is they're panic. They're in a panic mode trying to see if anybody is connecting. The whole population is trying to create the idea there is a community, a safety net, something that will be interested in you. So everybody's probing.
Sure.
So it's panic texting everywhere to see if anybody responds. Is there anybody still out there? That's the main mood. So what the president should say, or the prime minister should say, we've been in a state of war on 5 body levels. If we're not waiting for World War III or waiting for this or that war. We're in a state of war. Marshall called it the warfare-welfare state, right? Warfare-welfare state.
Yes.
And so we are in a state of war, and that should be discussed with kids without panicking them. Now, some of them will panic. They're going to have panic attacks. But I think that the ideas of getting comfort from a job or a career or becoming famous or making a lot of money, nothing comforts anymore. That's the first rule in school. Nothing.
That's
we are
right.
not going to comfort you.
Good
but
point.
The more you understand that, it's like developing a kind of what McLuhan called media yoga. So it would be a reality or an actual yoga without doing the postures that traditional Asian cultures provide. It is paying attention and being disciplined and not being set up that this way will save you. That's what's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And
no,
you got these kids who are naive.
Yeah.
They
that's
think...
Fun.
They run away from home, and I think there's some youthful group out there that's going to, they may be just squatters, you have those movements, but to think that they're going to protect you is erroneous. So we need to make the population very paranoid without getting unhappy. That's the new Zen problem for all forms of instruction.
By the way, that's an area, again, where Croker is actually pertinent because he wrote a book about panic.
Yes, the Panic Encyclopedia. And he begins by saying that human flesh is obsolete. There is no flesh. He says that the genes have jumped from the bodies and landed into the chip landscapes and are merging with the machinic to create a new reality, and the flesh has been left behind. At best, can be called surplus flesh. That's employed flesh. It's surplus flesh.
Do you know Szilard, the artist Szilard?
Yes, I even got the book that Croker and a bunch of people organized around him. Yes, Croker, emphasizes has been talking about him for 30 years. Yeah, I know, but I'm not impressed.
I know
Szilard
personally. I didn't know that. No, but he did say something which is very, very pertinent to what you have just said. The body is obsolete. That's his basic, he repeats that, it's his mantra, the body is obsolete,
yes,
and he actually did all his work to show that.
Well, no, he's panicking. He's not pointing out the building of the chip body and the TV body. He's saying there's something horrendous that's monitoring you, monitoring and surveilling and creating.
No. You got it all wrong.
I don't get things wrong, Derek. I don't get things wrong. I make statements that you can correct.
But I'm correcting your statement. Sellout is a lot more profound than that. He has done some very interesting exploration precisely to get into that, and he does it in every which way. He hung himself by 364 fish hooks from a crane 150 feet above the ground. That's panic art. For sure it is.
Yes.
It's a very interesting kind of approach, but it's also a very interesting statement on touch and on a transmission of a tactile sensation.
No, that's where he's wrong. He is stressing pain in the chemical body. He is not pointing out the pain in the chip body.
No. He's not true with that. What he did is to swallow a camera and a light to actually show the inside of his stomach. So after seeing that, I was giving a talk to 400 people in ICEA in, I think it was 1994, and ICEA was in Helsinki at the time, and I said, the artist is volcanic. He produces things that disgust or terrify people. And here's an example, I said, you have Szelák among us, and he's one of the most disgusting artists I know. Szelák comes up to me quite furious, and he says, disgusting. I said, that was the biggest compliment I could make you. Anyway, he laughed. It was a joke, and it was all meant to be. But it's true. The horror, actually, that is portrayed is also a revelation. It's also a kind of we are exposed to horror with all these people we were talking about before, and ISIS and so on. But the horror actually has a dimension of revelation. Bataille talked about this very well. You know, I'm not quite sure. But there is a tradition of this sort of thing, and I think Szelák plays a very big role into it.
Szelák is only communicating 1960s McLuhan reality. He doesn't get into the comfort, the user's friendliness of modern chip bodies and TV bodies. He misses the wonderful ecstasy and bliss that media bring into us. He's emphasizing the torture too much. Now, this bliss, though...
Well, he wired his own body to a television image that would actually reproduce his movement directly through his nervous system. So he was connecting his nervous system to the internet. You can't tell me that that's not, you know, the chip body.
No, that's too literal. That's too literal. He is wiring and connecting himself. There's no connection.
Okay, all right. Forget it. Let's drop Horstel out.
No.
The book you talk about, when was it done?
A few years ago, it's a beautiful book with all kinds of writers interpreting Szelák. It's a big hardcover. I don't have it right here. It's in the garage, but maybe I can go look it up for you and give you the title. It's an arty book.
Some other time.
Yeah, it's an arty book. Mm-hmm. But
okay,
you know where Szelák fails.
You don't remember the title.
The artist is only as good as his interviews. Szelák fails in his interviews. He says he's a reflex of McLuhan and this and that. You have to be very leading edge on your interview. That's where it's important. Your art is a means of getting attention for when you get interviewed. And that's Szelák did not do appropriate interviews. I claim that I'm the best interviewed person around. I go further than anybody. Nobody gets on there and declares that they have a cold fusion breakthrough and can actually back it up. Nobody can do that. I can. It's just that the media is not giving me any coverage. And, of course, they won't.
Sure, but the trouble is, are you using cold fusion to cool your hot Maui house?
No comment. No comment, Derek.
Listen, my man, I gotta run because I'm expected for dinner and I have to start doing things without it. So see tomorrow night. What?
No, we're doing good. This is one of our longest sessions. We did good tonight. You know?
Okay, I think that's fine. We can go on to generalism, science, futurism, and prophecy, maybe not tomorrow night. The night after, I'm in Nice.
Yes.
I'm moving. I'm going to Nice on the morning of the 6th. And what I mean the 6th? No, the 20th. The 20th of this month. And I'll be there till at least the 1st of March. So,
yes,
so we've got some time then.
All right. Very good. Thanks a lot, Derek.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.